This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. And today in your health, performing improv as a way to help cope with Alzheimer's disease. It may be hard to imagine the stress of knowing that you're losing your memory and being aware of that over time. You will no longer be able to care for yourself. In Chicago, a city known for improvisational theater, researchers are testing whether unscripted theater games can benefit newly diagnosed Alzheimer's patients. Reporter Julianne Hill has the story.
At 10:30 on Monday morning, about a dozen people file into an improvisational theater class.
Well, here they come.
Among them, a pretty blonde in her 50s, a woman who's a retired biologist and wears big glasses, and a retired professor.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Happy Monday morning.
The course is held in a conference room at Northwestern Memorial Hospital.
It is Monday.
And it looks like any continuing education class.
Shall we do a little yes and or pass the clap? What do we feel like today?
Let's do yes you.
Let's do yes you. Okay.
But these players are different.
Yes, you.
Yes, you.
Yes, you.
You.
Everyone in this ensemble has dementia. Mary O'Hara is a social worker at Northwestern's Cognitive Neurology and Alzheimer's Disease Center.
Improv is all about being in the moment, which for someone with memory loss is a really safe place. Maybe thinking about the past and trying to remember makes a person a little bit anxious or even a bit sad because their memory is failing. And maybe thinking about the future too much is also anxiety-provoking. So being in the moment is such a safe and a good place to be.
Northwestern's researchers are working with the Tony Award-winning Looking Glass Theater Company. There are theater programs using improv for Alzheimer's patients in the later stages of the disease, but this collaboration is unique because it's for early-stage patients.
There's no experience required. There's no script. There's no memorization. They bring to it just their creative potential, and they are so successful at this.
Okay, so we're going to take an object, and we're going to transform it into three things that it's not.
Christine Mary Dunford with the Looking Glass leads this group of novice performers in very simple improv games.
Some of the basic tenets of improv that are perfect for working with people with dementia are the concept of yes. So fundamental to all our work is the idea that whatever answer somebody comes up with, the rest of us are going to be able to work with it.
This is a red 5-pound mackerel.
Yes, it is!
My favorite moments are when they're delighting each other and they have a lot of fun. You know what I think my favorite exercise of all time is? Yes, it is. Because they take an object and they transform it, and they always surprise themselves and everybody else. And it's always magical and it's always exciting.
Researchers don't expect these games to stop or slow the Alzheimer's disease process. But they are investigating, does engaging the creative abilities of these early-stage patients improve their lives? Before and after the 8-week program, participants and their families are asked a series of questions, checking to see how the course might change their answers. Darby Morehart is a research associate professor at Northwestern.
Well, we're asking people to tell us how they're feeling about their physical health, their mood, how do they feel about their memory, how do they feel about their family, about their relationships, and also how do they feel about their current situation as a whole, and their life as a whole.
In the class, Dunford tells the players to stand in a circle for a listening game called Chord.
We're going to close our eyes and we're just going to hum on the same sound. After a while, when it starts feeling really good, anybody who wants to can change the pitch or add a different kind of sound.
After about 2 minutes, the chord morphs into nature sounds.
Okay, so what happened that was fun?
Spontaneity.
Spontaneity.
That's right.
Animal acceptance. Sounds I never thought I had.
We're never trying to be funny. I don't think we've ever even mentioned that word, comedy. we're just an improvisation group. We're the memory ensemble. We're an ensemble of people working together. So it ends up being funny quite often, but often, just as often, it ends up being touching or moving or provoking.
What should we name this out? The song we just made?
Chubby Chaos.
Chubby Chaos.
When we think of people with Alzheimer's and other dementia, we think about people who are losing skills on a daily basis. But here, they're learning some new things, too.
It gives them a feeling of self-confidence that they were able to accomplish this. And in this disease, there's not a lot of opportunity to feel a sense of accomplishment.
The group plays sculptor, molding one another into an emotion.
One of you is the sculptor, and one of you is the clay.
The players, like Wolfgang, each bring a lifetime of experience into the room.
I was a professor of Hebrew studies, Old Testament, in this university here. I mean, up in the northern suburb, what is it? See, I have Alzheimer's, and that's why I don't remember these things. But, you know, it's one of the big universities here in this area.
Caregivers are not invited to participate.
This is really an opportunity for the persons with the illness to be together. There's not a lot of options for them in the community to get to know one another and be within and to have their own program. And it also gives caregivers a much-needed break as well.
Wolfgang's wife, Mary Beth, waits for him outside the classroom.
It's an opportunity for us to enjoy something, to get out for the day and do something partly together and partly separately. My hopes for my husband is that he maintains this very sweet disposition. Some people with Alzheimer's don't, but I think that he's definitely going in that direction, and there's still so much of him, and we still have a deep relationship. The hardest thing for me is that it can't really grow.
Now let's put your body like this one and see what that's how somebody else feels, Hope. Feel that?
It's too early in the study to know whether this course is affecting the quality of life of these patients. But for his part, Wolfgang feels things have changed for himself and his fellow players.
I think we all have become more thoughtful in terms of the world in which we live. And it will then indirectly show itself in our interaction within our family. I have grandchildren, you know, I have a wife, etc., etc., and also in the wider world.
The session closes with some questions.
I'm wondering how I should describe to a friend what we are celebrating.
What we're celebrating or what we're doing?
Both. You know, a lot of times in our situation, you know, we're sitting around talking about our problems and our difficulties. And here we are not talking about our problems and our difficulties. We are having fun and enjoying ourselves.
True, true.
We're normal.
Normal, that's right.
For NPR News, I'm Julianne Hill.
Finally this hour, a new basketball shoe that is touted to dramatically reduce ankle injuries. Ankle sprains and breaks are the most common injury in the NBA, and they're largely treated as just part of the game. Well, one new shoe company says it can change that. NPR's Mike Pesca tells us about its prospects.
No one pays to watch Kobe ride the pine or to assess Kevin Durant's towel-waving skills. But that's what we've seen from these NBA stars at different points last season, all because of ankle injuries. Tim Duncan, LeBron James, Amari Stoudemire, Gilbert Arenas, Kwame Brown. From stars to scrubs and in between, ankle injuries are the common denominator, or deactivator. Enter Barry Katz, former college basketball player, radiologist, visionary.
We've solved the problem. We can't say 100%, but we're confident that we'll knock out 99% of ankle injuries.
Katz is the inventor of the Ectio, a sturdy, one might say, imposing shoe that features a system of straps and dorsal protrusions called side rollers. It's an unquestionably serious sneaker, so Ectio sought to outfit serious players. Brooklyn-based pro-am team, the X-Men. One of the X-Men, Malcolm Connor, who's played professionally in Chile, spoke of the footwear the team is now sporting.
Of course, seeing a new sneaker, you're a little skeptical, like, okay, it's not Nike, it's not Adidas, let me see what it's about. But after trying them on, you know, and the reassurance of not spraining the ankle and everything like that, you know, it kind of clears your mind, allows you to play free up and down, you know?
The X-Men's founder, Daitanya Mixon, says his team, which just won the prestigious Rucker Park tournament, has experienced only one ankle injury all summer.
Everything is a fad, and right now Nike has a fad. You know, everybody want to wear Nike. They don't care about ankle injury. They don't care. They want the look. You know, they're not thinking about health-wise. That's what the XTO is, definitely protects the ankle injury, definitely. You cannot roll your ankle no matter how much you try.
It does seem that considerations other than safety dictate the choice of shoe for most professionals. Former New York Knicks guard John Starks puts his finger on how he made decisions concerning his ankles.
The money. You know, most guys don't even think about, you know, the safety of the shoe or what have you. You know, they think more so about the money. And I was a young player then, had a family to feed.
Starks is now part owner of Ectio, so you could say it's still about the money. But he says he wishes Ectio had been around when he was wrapping his tender ankles in tape. Historically, shoes do not seem to be getting safer. Foot injuries are up more than 60% over the past two decades. Barry Katz says Ectios can solve this problem. He compares the shoe to a familiar piece of sports equipment.
What we did is we created a very light ski boot, 15 to 16 ounces. So while tape is attached to your foot, the shoe can still roll over when you land on someone's foot. If the shoe rolls over, you tear your ligaments and you sprain your ankle. We keep the foot and the shoe together so this doesn't happen.
There is a problem with this analogy, however. Dr. Benno Nigg, founder of the Human Performance Laboratory at the University of Calgary, says the ski boot itself has been rethought.
In the old days, the ski boots were very, very soft and flexible, and then they made them stiffer and stiffer, and with that they reduced the number of ankle injuries but increased the number of knee injuries. You want to have all the muscles that you have in your body involved in the whole process of the movement. A shoe that is very stiff and very rigid doesn't do that.
Nigg is an undisputed expert in the field, but it must be disclosed that he's accepted funding from big shoe companies, including Adidas, throughout his career. He says that the studies Ectio's commissioned are insufficient to make any claims about injury reduction. He has worn the sneakers, however, and he says...
I thought it was a good feeling.
But he says proof of the shoe's effectiveness would require a study that would be fairly costly for a small company like Ectio. On the other hand, if thousands of players wear Ectio sneakers on their own, that could provide important data. Of course, it's hard for a bit player to outfit thousands absent a verifiable scientific claim. So as it stands, this small shoe company is hoping to get a break for its product that hopes to prevent them. Mike Pesca, NPR News, New York.
There's hope stocks will stabilize this week after the wild swings of last week. And for a measure of investor concern, we can turn to the Volatility Index, or VIX, also known as the fear gauge. It essentially trades on expectations for the performance of companies listed on the S&P 500. NPR's Yuki Noguchi has more on the VIX index.
It was 1992 in Burgundy, France. Professor Robert Whaley was on sabbatical. He'd bought a house in the town of Aunay-en-Bazois, an idyllic setting to devise something called the fear gauge.
Were you drinking wine at the time, and did that make it easier?
We did enjoy the wines while we were there, but it wasn't a key element in the index design.
He brought two computers with lots of horsepower. He fed them a bunch of numbers dating back to 1986 in order to find a mathematical formula that could isolate and predict volatility.
VIX gives you a notion of how uncertain the market is.
Most economic data, like unemployment and GDP growth, are backward-looking. The VIX gives you something different because it's based on prices of contracts to buy stocks in the future. Whaley, now a professor at Vanderbilt, compares VIX to insurance.
If there's a hurricane brewing, homeowners in its path are willing to pay more for home insurance. The price for insurance goes up, and VIX is like insurance.
The market's becoming nervous that the value of their stock portfolios are going to fall. They go rush out and buy portfolio insurance.
That's why a higher VIX tends to gauge market fear. During a normal ho-hum kind of trading day, the VIX is about 17. During the stock market crash of October 1987, the VIX, had it existed, would have hit 117. Last Monday, the first trading day after the U.S. lost its top credit rating, the VIX reached 48. There are a host of ways to bet on VIX. In fact, it was developed for that purpose at the behest of the Chicago Board Options Exchange. The VIX is based on the S&P 500 index, but there are similar measures based on gold and oil, as well as the Dow, the NASDAQ, and other stock indices around the world. Ben Londergan is chief executive of Group One, a firm that facilitates the buying and selling of VIX options. He spends his days in the trading pit of the Chicago Options Exchange, an especially chaotic place these days.
30 people are screaming at one guy, 30 people are screaming at another guy.
And they're yelling things like this.
September 25, 32, call 1 by 2, what's your market?
With the stock market logging huge single-day gains and losses, the volume of VIX-related trades hit record highs this month.
This is going to sound a little pathetic, but it's physically exhausting. I mean, it's mentally extremely draining.
Londergan says market crashes are good for his business, but personally it's not fun to profit off of fear.
As the markets are imploding and you see lots of very negative things happening, you tend to have perhaps a professional victory that is very, very bittersweet.
The professor who developed VIX in the first place, Robert Whaley, says he uses it to evaluate his own trades. If the VIX is high, he's less likely to act on specific company stocks.
I remember the day that I was, October 1987, I was presenting to a bunch of fund managers. These people were walking around with these blank looks on their faces, and that was an extremely anxious time.
Whaley recently bet volatility was going to go up, but he was 2 months too early, and he didn't make any money. But that's okay, he says. Hearing other people discuss the fear gauge he developed is a thrill all its own. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
More news now from the mobile market. Last week, Facebook rolled out a new standalone app called Messenger. It allows users to send and receive messages directly from their smartphones while avoiding charges from service providers. In other words, a free alternative to texting. To help explain how it works, I'm joined by Brian Cooley, editor-at-large at the online tech magazine CNET. Welcome back to the program, Brian.
Thanks, Robert.
And I did this. I tried this out this morning. I messaged my two daughters. A 50% response rate is pretty good in my family.
Yeah.
I want you to explain what just happened. What did I do?
Well, you just used a new Facebook app called Facebook Messenger. It's different from the Facebook app, which has all the Facebook wall updates and all that sort of thing. They've chosen to go with a separate app for communications that rolls in not just Facebook messages, but also you can field email and text messages through there. In other words, they're trying to roll all your communications into one app that happens to be a Facebook app.
And this is not unique. There are other things. Google has something like it, I gather.
There are a ton of apps out there for different kinds of communication. Many of them take existing platforms, generic platforms, email, texting, things of that nature that exist as utilities, and they roll them up in what we call a new skin. They put them into a new basket, but what's in there is the same core technology. So yes, these are apps that have been around for a while, but Facebook hasn't done one of these until just now.
Is Facebook's advantage here simply the number of people who have Facebook pages, or is there something about it and its technology that's different from what Apple or Google is trying to do?
Yeah, the big advantage here is that Facebook has everybody in the tent already. You could launch a new Messenger app today, and nobody would use it unless you got really lucky. What Facebook can do is they can get in front of a parade. They don't have to start a parade. So they can put this in front of 750 or 800 million registered users right now and get immediate uptake of some significant degree.
Here's what I don't understand. If Verizon makes money from my texting when I use ordinary messaging, how is it that Facebook can deliver the same service without getting any money for it?
Well, what Facebook is doing is they're rolling the message through a different network. They're rolling it over the web through their own platform. They're rolling it through Facebook, basically. So they are recreating a channel that is just like the texting you're using on SMS, but it's through a Facebook server. And so they are taking a side road around, not really cutting out the middleman, but taking a different route to get the message there.
But I assume then that if I were a mobile carrier manning the toll booth on the main highway, I'd be pretty upset about these detours going up.
Yeah, as I look at an app like this, I see the carriers perhaps having some pushback. They obviously want you to use as much data on your plan as possible, because if they're lucky, you'll use more data than you're currently paying for and either get stuck with an overage charge at the end of the month, or you'll say, okay, that didn't feel good. I'm going to raise my plan.
What are some potential downsides, though, to Facebook?
Well, when you install anything from Facebook, you get that sort of that tinge of invasiveness. That's something where Facebook is a, let's say, a contentious entity, whereas most of us will look at email and texting and we'll see that as, yeah, those are just generic utilities. I don't feel like there's anybody in there promoting it or bringing it to me in a way where they want something, where they have an ulterior motive. When you look at Facebook, you say, okay, what do they want? All users pretty much realize now they want my information. They want to have their fingers in my communications so they can better tune advertising to me. And a lot of people are uncomfortable with that.
Brian Cooley, editor-at-large with the online magazine CNET. Brian, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Robert.
Saddam Hussein was a brutal dictator feared by all. Hard as it may be to imagine, his eldest son, Uday, had an even worse reputation. In the years before Uday was killed in 2003 by American Special Forces, he was known as a drug-addled womanizer who abducted and raped schoolgirls and once, on an impulse, killed his father's best friend. Uday was dangerous and also in danger. Like his father Saddam, he needed a body double, a fideh, which in Arabic translates to bullet catcher. So Uday Hussein summoned a former schoolmate, a young man named Latif Yahya, and made him an offer he couldn't refuse. Here's how it plays out in the new movie, The Devil's Double.
Look at yourself, Latif. Look at me. We could be twins, no?
You are taller.
How much? This much? Didn't they used to say you look like Uday Saddam Hussein? Didn't they used to say that at school?
I want you to be my brother. What happens if I say no?
The new gangster-style film is set around the time of Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. British actor Dominic Cooper plays both roles, the body double Latif, who's the moral center of the film, and Uday Hussein, the villain. Dominic Cooper joined us from London. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the one of your two roles, the role of Uday, a spoiled man-child who, as the dictator's son, he could literally do anything he wanted. Describe him for us.
I was horrified by everything that I unearthed about him, everything that I researched or found out. He was, as you say, an uncontrollable playboy with access to as much money, drugs, alcohol, women, anything that he pleased. All that I could think about when needing to get into his headspace was, I suppose, that he had an extremely awful upbringing. And any son of a dictator, I mean, I'm sure has major issues with their father, and Saddam certainly didn't believe in Uday's military capabilities. He wasn't ever going to give him the reins of power, so he put him in charge of various, you know, like the Olympic Committee, but all I could see that he did with the Olympic Committee was torture athletes for no reason, expecting results from athletes by beating them. A madman.
Although he, I mean, in the end, for someone viewing the film, he's compelling because he's just so weird and creepy.
Yeah, there's a certain level, I suppose, of comedy. He's almost a cartoon, I think. What was important was when I realized, I think, that we weren't making an accurate biographical, detailed or historical account of these events or these people, that it gave me the opportunity to actually just create two distinctive people in the hope that the audience were always aware of which one they were watching. I think that was essential.
The real Latif actually had some plastic surgery to help make a more complete transformation to Uday. And you show that in the film. Talk to us about that.
Well, I've met Latif on several occasions, and he's physically scarred from the operations that he had to change his appearance.
Which is sort of minimal in the film. Was it more...
It's minimal in the film, because what we're dealing with in the film is the same actor playing these two roles, which is me. So what we decided upon was to make Latif slightly different with the use of prosthetics at the beginning of the film, and then I just had the prosthetic teeth to play with, which were incredible, and they create a whole change in vocality and physicality, actually.
They're sort of a little, to describe them, rodent-like.
He did have extraordinarily strange teeth. Why he went, who could have anything in the world that he possibly desired or wanted. And he obviously wasn't concerned with dental care. But I often heard actors say, I only feel that the character comes alive when they step into the shoes of this person. Certainly with Uday, I felt that these teeth changed the whole behavior. It was extraordinary.
Well, just in terms of what you had to do then, again, to transform, the film had a relatively small budget, which I gather put a bit more pressure on you to move from one character to the next rather quickly.
Well, I would ask essentially to play Uday first. He was so much in charge of a scene and a space, and he was the driving force in each scene. I mean, I thought it was more tiring and energetic to play Uday. Now, if it had been a larger budget or we were filming this in a different way with much more time, I would stay as Uday maybe for a day, maybe 2 days, and then go back into the headspace of Latif. What I had to do in this particular project was do the establishing shot as Uday, preempt and second guess what my performance as Latif was going to be, and therefore react and respond to how I imagined Latif to react and respond. Then I'd run off quickly as possible, run back into the same location, shoot exactly the same master shot, and then I would be reacting, responding to a memory of my performance as Uday with a earpiece to react and respond to of the performance that I gave, and then have to remember where I was standing in that particular space as Uday so that the eye lines would be exact. If they were out by millimeters, the scene would fall apart and it wouldn't work.
Latif ended up being a body double for a couple of years. There was no escape. His family would have been in danger if he escaped, or at least that's what he was told. But one thing that makes this as much a thriller as a true story is Latif seemed to be at all times in danger. Let's play another clip where it's the father of a kidnapped schoolgirl, and the father actually has the nerve to come and face Uday to get some answers, and instead he finds himself facing Latif, and Uday directs Latif to kill the father.
You put a bullet in his head, now, now!
What has he done?
What has he done?
He's a man who has lost his daughter.
You heard what he said about you?
About me?
About you, Uday Saddam Hussein!
It was not me who snatched her off the street. I didn't beat her. If you want to kill him yourself.
You think you can pick and choose? You think you can pick and choose? You are nothing!
I'm not going to kill this man. Kill me if you want. I don't care.
You would die to save this man?
Well, go on. What are you waiting for? Kill me. Put a bullet in my head.
You know, Latif Yahya is still alive and living in Europe. There are a lot of people who have experienced a lot of pain, most particularly since the war in Iraq. How did you come to terms with being in a film that turns something that's quite real, you know, into a gangster movie?
That's really tough, and I don't think we're showing them in a glamorous light. You know, even it's a gangster film. It's fast-paced. It's got guns, fast cars and girls, drugs and booze. And that's what life seemed to really be about. And this is a family of gangsters who run a country like gangsters. And we needed to exploit this certain story in a way that's beneficial to an audience watching it. So it's not a history lesson, but it's a compelling story about the, you know, the inner workings of this regime that actually I think an awful lot of us know very little about, although it's very much in our recent past and very much part of our history.
Dominic Hooper, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Dominic Hooper stars in the new movie The Devil's Double.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. The new novel, The Submission, centers on post-9/11 America. It's about an anonymous competition to pick the design for a memorial at Ground Zero and the furor that erupts when it's revealed the designer is Muslim American. The novelist is Amy Waldman. She's a former New York Times reporter who covered 9/11 in New York and afterward was based in South Asia. Here she is reading from her novel, the description of the winning memorial design.
The concept was simple. A walled, rectangular garden guided by rigorous geometry. At the center would be a raised pavilion meant for contemplation. Two broad, perpendicular canals quartered the six-acre space. Pathways within each quadrant imposed a grid on the trees, both living and steel, that were studded in orchard-like rows.
That design was created by the character Mohammed Khan, an architect, a non-observant Muslim, an agnostic. Born in the USA, he goes by the name Mo. And yet, when the jury choosing the memorial discovers his identity, he faces intense pressure from all sides to explain his design and to denounce the terrorist attacks. As Amy Waldman explains, Khan stubbornly refuses to respond.
From his point of view, he keeps saying, you would never ask these questions of a designer who wasn't Muslim, so why should I have to answer these questions? I refuse to accept that I should be treated any differently than anybody else. I had nothing to do with these attacks. I'm not going to answer the questions. From some of the jurors and from many Americans, they're coming back at him and saying, things changed with this attack, and you do have to answer these questions. You do have to reassure us. And if you think these attacks were wrong, why won't you come out and say so?
There's also a building pressure on Mohammed Khan to withdraw, to say, okay, I take myself out of this competition.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there are a lot of people who take that position, including people very close to him and including some Muslim Americans who say, this isn't good for us. We don't need this right now. We have sort of fought so hard to a place of normalcy or acceptability in the wake of this attack. The last thing we need is another controversy. So, you know, if you really care about us, you should withdraw.
You know, this does sound a lot like the recent fight over what became known as the Ground Zero Mosque in Manhattan. But the timing seems wrong for that. You would have had to been working on this book for some time before that.
Oh, yes. Yes. I was working on it well before that. I had the idea initially in 2003 or 2004 and started working on it probably in 2007. It definitely put an interesting spin on things. I went back and did some rewriting only because the book certainly plays off reality and I have no problem with that, but I didn't want it to feel like a transcription of reality.
Mm. What were some things that you decided you needed to rewrite given what you were learning?
Watching the sort of way that blew up and the kind of craziness, I think it opened out my imagination in the sense of thinking there are certain events in the book that were not in there before this happened. The specter of violence was not in the book as much from both sides or all sides. But I think just the way that kind of crept up around that controversy and the controversy that sort of bubbled up around the country, you know, the taxi driver who was stabbed in New York, there were desecrations at mosques, there are also threats from Islamic extremists, all of that kind of stuff. Or the fear of threats, I started thinking about that more, and that found its way more strongly into the novel.
What questions about sort of the discussion, the debate in America right now, do you think you're trying to get at with this novel?
I think in the wake of 9/11, like a lot of Americans, you know, we were all very traumatized by the attacks, traumatized in a totally different way by some of what happened afterward in response. And I think there have been these questions hovering in the past decade of what kind of country are we? Who are we? What are we justified in changing because of this? What does it mean to be America and American today? And then looking specifically at Mohammed Khan, even who is an American? And so those kinds of questions were what I was interested in exploring.
And this conflict you're describing escalates well beyond this architect and this design for the memorial. There's a group that springs up called Save America from Islam. There are incidents of headscarf pulling, people ripping headscarves off of Muslim women, and Muslim self-defense patrols that spring up. How did you start thinking about a scenario like that?
Well, I just started thinking the way in public controversies like this, one thing leads to another, and suddenly it's out of control in ways nobody could predict or necessarily wanted, and some of that is fed by the media. But some of it is just individuals reacting and acting, and that's an entirely separate thread I was really interested in exploring in the novel. I mean, if you look at this character of Sean Gallagher, whose brother was a firefighter who died in this attack, and he's become an activist but is also a little bit trying to find his feet in the world, and he really just pulls this headscarf out of impulse and rage and all these conflicting feelings and frustration going on in him. And it just unleashes all these copycats and then the self-defense squads in response. And I think that is sort of, I'm interested in how these things spiral and change through time.
I'm talking with Amy Waldman about her novel, The Submission. How delicate a dance was it for you to talk about victims' families and the competing pressures among the families in that community?
It was delicate. You know, I didn't seek out victims' families and someone to talk to, partly because I didn't feel right asking them to offer up their experience for a novel, but also I didn't want to be sitting there worrying, would they like this? Would they not like this? Would they be offended? Is this true to their experience? That would paralyze me as a fiction writer. And I think, you know, if you look at the last 10 years, they are not a monolith either. I mean, they are all kinds of opinions, all kinds of politics. They're human beings like anybody else, and they've all reacted to this event and everything that's come afterward in very different ways. And I felt like it was honest to try to represent that.
You know, coming up on the 10-year anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, and there will be the unveiling, the opening of the memorial at Ground Zero, I wonder if you'll sort of process that in a whole different way, given your immersion in this novel.
I think I will. It's somebody just asked me where I was planning to be on 9/11, and I hadn't thought about it, but I do know I want to be in New York. And it's strange. I mean, there's the whole way the novel is sort of braided with reality, I think will climax in some strange way in seeing that memorial open. So yeah, it will be an interesting time for many reasons.
Amy Waldman, her novel is titled The Submission. Amy, thanks very much.
Thank you, Melissa.